song, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo is here with an episode of Words and Their Stories that will work like a charm if you are hoping to learn some English phrases that have to do with luck. Then, Andrew Smith and Jill Robbins are here with this week's Higher Education Report. Then, Kelly Jean Kelly joins us with the latest part in our series on America's presidents. This week, it's Millard Fillmore. Now, here's Ana Mateo.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On today's program, we talk about the word charm. Charm has several meanings. It can be a word, action, or thing believed to have magic power, to keep away evil, or to bring good luck. It can be a small item worn on a chain or bracelet. Charm bracelets are popular because you can add charms that show things you like. Charm is also a quality that attracts and pleases people. If you are charming, you charm people. In the story Cinderella, the prince is called Prince Charming. Now let's talk about our first expression. If something works like a charm, it works perfectly. Something that works like a charm does exactly what it is supposed to do. This expression can describe an approach, a method, a tactic, or even a device. Whatever it is works so well that it seems like magic. Let's hear two friends use it. One friend invites another to go boating for the weekend. But before that can happen, the invitee must find a dog watcher for the weekend.
So, can you go boating with me this weekend?
Yes. My roommate agreed to watch my dog, Milo.
She did? I thought she didn't like Milo at all.
Me too. She complains about my dog all the time. Milo is too big. Milo is too playful. Milo is too whatever.
So, why did she agree to watch him?
Well, I told her that when I take Milo to the dog park, lots of men want to play with such a big, friendly dog. And I added that some of these men are very good-looking.
Oh, that is too funny.
It might be funny, but it worked like a charm.
Now for our next expression. Let's say a person tries to do something but fails at it two times or twice. But they want to try again for a third time. They hope that on the third attempt, it will work. In this situation, we can say the third time is the charm. However, when we use this expression, we usually say it quickly, like this, third time's the charm. We often use this expression to encourage someone to do something that they have tried a couple of times. Here is another conversation using the expression, third time's the charm.
Where are you going with all those boxes?
I'm helping James open his new business.
James is opening another business? Didn't his past two businesses fail?
They did. He lost a lot of money on both of them.
Wow, he is brave for starting another business. You'd think he would have learned his lesson.
He said the third time's the charm. He really believes this one will work out.
What is the business anyway?
He is opening a dog summer camp.
A summer camp for dogs?
Yep. Those boxes are filled with dog treats and toys.
But people love spending time with their dogs in the summer.
Look, I'm just helping him out.
This expression may have its roots in old superstitions. It means that the third time will be lucky. Word experts say that some cultures throughout history viewed three as a lucky number. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
On an April evening in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, members of the Carolina Flyers are playing a fast-paced practice game. The Flyers are a men's professional ultimate frisbee team. Their opponent is Darkside, the University of North Carolina, UNC, men's team. And the students are playing very well against the professionals. One of the players for Darkside is Lucien Noel, a student from Australia studying abroad this year at UNC. Back home, he had seen video of Darkside and liked the team's fast way of playing. So when he learned his Australian university had an exchange program with UNC, he was excited to come to the U.S. and get a chance to join the team. Halfway through the game, Noel makes a diving left-handed catch to keep the frisbee disc in Darkside's hands. When Darkside scores a point seconds later, teammates run onto the field in loud celebration. Darkside has won the last two intercollegiate national championships. The team hopes to make it three in a row later this year.
On the other side of the country, the University of California, Santa Barbara, or UCSB, is home to another top university team. That team is called Black Tide. Daniel Huang is one of the Black Tide players. Growing up, Huang lived in four countries, South Korea, Singapore, Indonesia, and China. He started playing ultimate in middle school in Shanghai. Watching videos of U.S.-based teams increased his interest in the sport. "I was intrigued by ulti culture in the U.S.," Huang said. "Ulti is short for ultimate." According to the organization USA Ultimate, the sport is played in over 80 countries by an estimated 7 million people. Unlike most sports, ultimate does not use officials to make rulings on the field. Instead, players promise to obey the rules and try to make fair decisions about rule violations during play. Players call this the spirit of the game. An official ultimate field is 100 meters long and 37 meters wide. Each team has seven players on the field, and they must run quickly during points. Teams get points by catching a pass in the opponent's end zone. Both Huang and Noel say that playing ultimate has given them something more than fun and exercise. It has also helped them form close connections with American students. Noel currently lives with five other players on the UNC team.
It's like the most together form of ultimate frisbee there is. That goes beyond training and playing with the team.
Noel also talked about the importance of spending time with team members outside of practice. He said spending time with the players outside of practice helps create very, very special bonds. Eugenia Chow agrees. The third-year student from Hong Kong plays on the UNC women's team, Pleiades. Like the UNC men's team, Pleiades is ranked number one in the country. Chow said being on the team helps her connect with people, and joining a team has helped her feel open to other experiences as well.
Wang at UCSB thinks international students who play Ultimate are more likely to be involved with American students and their culture. Wang lives in an apartment, but he often spends time at the house of several teammates who live together.
I really didn't want myself to be just like stuck in an apartment just studying, and because that's kind of like all these international students are doing. They're just like in their rooms, simply just studying, and then every now and then maybe play games, like video games.
University players usually spend 6 to 8 hours each week training. Many teams also play 5 to 7 weekend competitions in the spring and 3 to 5 competitions in the autumn. At competitions, teams usually play 4 games on Saturday and 3 on Sunday. To deal with the physical demands, teams often have up to 28 players. Because there are no referees on the field, intercollegiate ultimate is not governed by the National Collegiate Athletic Association. Schools do not provide sports scholarships or money for ultimate players. Each player pays a yearly fee to help pay for the costs of clothes, equipment, and travel. Under the lights, the UNC team has won the first 3 of the short practice games against the Flyers. Before the evening's final game, the Flyers coach tells his players that Darkside has played faster and with more energy than they have. He tells his team to match the students' intensity. The professional players win the last mini game 5-3. But it is clear the UNC players loved every minute of the action. Back in California, Huang said he is happy he gets a chance to study computer science and also play Ultimate. I have my academic life, but I flip this switch where I have all this freedom and being so open to opportunities and being able to do so many different things with so many different types of people is just awesome, he said. I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English broadcast. Andrew, last time we talked, we spoke about an important issue, affirmative action. Today, we're talking about a recreational activity enjoyed by a lot of college students, Ultimate Frisbee.
That's right, Dan.
So, Ultimate Frisbee is played by 7 million people in 80 countries. But why do you think it is so popular with college and university students?
I think one big reason is that unlike some of the larger sports such as basketball and American football, students are the ones who organize the sport. They get to decide when and where they play, what kind of team uniforms they want to wear, who can join their teams, and many other details. That gives a sense of ownership and maybe also freedom. And then I think the other reason is you do not need an athletic scholarship, for example, to play on an ultimate team. It's open to anyone who wants to come join and learn the sport and get better and enjoy it.
And it also seems to be a very social game. The players practice many hours each week and also live together. Some of those students are international students. What did they get from living with students from the U.S. and not just seeing them in class?
As Lucy and Noel said, it helps form deep connections, or as we say, really deep bonds. So it's not like just going to a club meeting with other American students once a week. It gives international students a really high level of involvement. And of course, this is also really important for developing their English skills because they are with American students in many different contexts.
Thanks, Andrew. It also seems like these players are in it for the love of the game rather than making money. So how do you think Ultimate's spirit of the game, ideal, connects to that love for the sport?
I think the spirit of the game gives a unique feel to playing the sport where it builds a community of trust in that everybody has agreed to try to do their best, to play fairly, to not break the rules. And because it's in the official rules of the game and it's something that's emphasized when people are learning or at tournaments, and teams get awards for having the best spirit, I think it just adds to a fun culture where there's a lot of positive feelings.
Thanks, Andrew. I've enjoyed playing Frisbee with friends during maybe a picnic or at the park, but after listening to this story, maybe I'll try to find a game to play in. Thanks for talking about the sport with me and our listeners.
You're welcome, Dan. Happy to help.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Millard Fillmore, the 13th President of the United States. Fillmore is also likely the least remembered president. He has been called uninspiring and having only some competence. But Fillmore provided an example of the American dream come true. He rose from a poor family to become a wealthy man. He was elected to Congress 4 times and nominated for vice president under Zachary Taylor. When Taylor unexpectedly died in office in 1850, Fillmore took his place. Other presidents' campaigns, such as Andrew Jackson's, had spoken proudly of their candidates' modest beginnings. William Henry Harrison's supporters especially linked him with the image of a simple house called a log cabin, even though William Henry Harrison was a wealthy man. But Millard Fillmore really was born in a log cabin. His family was poor. They raised him and his seven brothers and sisters in a rural part of New York State. Fillmore did not receive much education as a child. However, he was very interested in learning, so interested that he fell in love with his teacher, Abigail Powers. The two married after he launched his career as a lawyer. They had two children, a son and a daughter. Millard Fillmore soon entered politics. He won elections to the New York State Assembly and then to the U.S. House of Representatives. After 8 years in Washington, D.C., Fillmore returned to New York. He failed to be elected governor, but succeeded to become comptroller of New York. In other words, he oversaw the state's finances. At that time, Americans were preparing for another presidential election. President James Polk was retiring from the White House after only one term, as he had promised. The opposition party, the Whigs, nominated Zachary Taylor as their presidential candidate. Taylor, a popular war hero from the South, owned slaves. But the Whigs realized that many anti-slavery voters in the North would not support Taylor. Party leaders were looking for someone to balance the ticket. A Northerner voters would consider a friend of business. They found Millard Fillmore. In 1847, the Whigs nominated Fillmore as Taylor's vice president. The two men had never met, and when they did meet, they did not like each other very much. Taylor was short-legged, poorly educated, and rarely seemed concerned about his physical appearance. Fillmore was taller, learned, and elegant. Their personalities did not fit together any better than their appearances did. But a majority of voters liked them. The Whigs won the election, and Fillmore returned to Washington. As vice president, Millard Fillmore was the leader of the Senate. But President Taylor did not seek his advice on the major political issue of the day. At the time, both lawmakers and the public were debating whether the government should, and could, ban slavery in the territories the U.S. had gained after the war with Mexico. In general, Northerners did not want to permit slavery in new states. But many Southerners did. The debate was so heated that one of the Southern states, South Carolina, threatened to leave the Union. President Taylor did not want to expand slavery. To restrict it, he proposed a change to the rules so California and New Mexico could enter the Union quickly as slave-free states. But before Taylor's idea could get too far, he became sick. Fillmore learned the president was not well and prepared for the worst. It came. Taylor died after being in office for only 16 months. The following day, Fillmore was sworn in as president. One of Fillmore's first acts as president was to show where he stood on the slavery issue. He appointed a man who opposed Taylor to Secretary of State. That man, Daniel Webster, and others, wanted to pass a compromise bill on slavery. With Fillmore's support, they succeeded. The Compromise of 1850 included several measures related to slavery. Two measures limited it. California was admitted as a free state, and the slave trade in Washington, D.C. ended. On the other hand, New Mexico and Utah were left open to slavery, and both the federal government and ordinary citizens were required to return suspected escaped slaves to their owners. That last measure, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, targeted even free African Americans and enslaved people who had escaped to free states. The compromise aimed to end the conflict between pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces. But neither side was really satisfied. And President Fillmore did not help matters. He was personally opposed to slavery. However, he did not act on his beliefs. Instead, he tried to keep the South in the Union by strongly enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act. By the end of Fillmore's 3 years in the White House, many members of his Whig Party were angry with him. Party leaders did not nominate him again for the next election. But their chosen candidate was not successful either. Fillmore turned out to be the last Whig president. The end of Fillmore's presidency included difficulty in his private life, too. His wife, Abigail, became sick on the day the next president was sworn in. She died within a month. Soon after, Fillmore's daughter died, too. To help deal with their loss, Fillmore tried to stay active in politics. In the presidential election of 1856, Fillmore served as the candidate for a new party, the Know-Nothing Party. The Know-Nothings were strongly opposed to immigration. They especially wanted to limit the number of Irish Catholics who could come to the United States. Fillmore did not agree with the party's anti-immigration policies, but he did not have a chance to put his opinions into policy. Fillmore finished third out of the three major candidates in the election. After that loss, he finally retired to the city of Buffalo, New York. There, Fillmore married a second time to a wealthy widow named Carolyn McIntosh. He remained an important figure in the city's charities and other causes. But the political situation in the country grew only more intense. Americans continued to be divided over the issue of slavery. Fillmore's time in office and his compromise bill may have delayed, but did not stop, the American Civil War. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.